Right. Well, we are in the studio here at McCam in Middleborough, Massachusetts, and I am joined today by John Brella and Matt Phillips. And we're here on behalf of Cardinal Tenants, who is partnering with the GOAT podcast in an effort to give a home for government oversight, accountability, and transparency, which really sort of finds its own place at the heart of Cardinal Tenants, which is seeking to find common sense, reason, and a middle ground in everyday life events and issues. So we're happy to have you on our site and happy to dive into this podcast with you guys. John, I'll turn it over to you to get it kicked off.
Thanks very much. We're happy to be here. Great intro. So this is GOAT podcast number one. We're going to talk about why we're here, how we plan to help the community. So let me tell you a little bit what we're going to talk about. We'll do some introductions, who we are. We'll then jump into why we're here. Then we'll look a little bit further into how we plan to help the community with government oversight, accountability, and transparency, and then what the community can expect next. And then once we get through those four things, we'll jump into one or two issues that have been top of mind with some people in the community and things that have been already put out there on Facebook. And we're looking to really help the community better understand the government which serves them. I think we should probably just get started. So, sound good?
Sounds good to me.
All right. So, introductions. Turn it back to you.
All right. I guess I'll kick it off. And I'll start by apologizing for my voice. I did get a sinus infection last week, so I'm on the upswing. But Tom Rochars, longtime Middleborough resident, native. Earlier this year, I founded Cardinal Tenants. It is fanfare for the common sense. It's really an approach based on the philosophical foundations of Plato and Aristotle, trying to get out of the weeds when we look at issues that we encounter these days, whether it's in business, life, politics. But it's trying to find that middle ground that can be so hard to find these days. Get things out of the dark, into the light, have open, productive conversations about them so everybody walks away understanding more, learning a little bit, and being able to figure a way to compromise and move forward.
Sounds good. Yep. I'm John Barella. I've been in Middleborough since 2005 with my wife and two young sons. I'm the former chair of the Finance Committee. I'm still full transparency on the Finance Committee. Serving in my second term and have enjoyed doing that greatly. I have learned a lot, and I see opportunities for the town government to improve. I think they have done some decent things in terms of more transparency. I think we have a lot of work yet to do, and that's why we're here. So that's a little bit about me and my background, and turn it over to Matt.
Lastly, I'm Matt Phillips. I've been in town majority of my life. I was born and raised in Middleborough. Left for a period when I joined the Marine Corps and also when I worked as a government contractor, but found my way back to Middleborough. And like John, I also serve on the Finance Committee. I'm at the tail end of my first term, which will expire in April. And the reason why I'm here is just to be a voice for the resident and taxpayer. I have no ulterior motives other than to ensure the prudent, efficient, and responsible spending of your tax money. This is something that is important to me to ensure that we're getting the greatest return on our investment, an investment that we have no choice but to pay. So I think it's even more important that we hold those people who are in charge of the purse strings accountable and to where they can show us with facts, with data, how our money's being spent, where it's being spent, and to ensure that, again, we're getting the greatest return on investment. So with that being said, now that we got our introductions out of the way, let's dive into it. So where do we start? we've got quite a bit of material that we can start with. So I don't know. I'll pass it over. Where should we begin?
Yeah, sure. So great question. So also, I just wanted to throw in there how we plan on helping the community, which is, keeping oversight on local government. I think that's very much needed. We're certainly not the only group in towns in Massachusetts that are doing this, so this is nothing new. I think it's needed, but nothing new. We're going to advise the community on the government's activities and provide some thought leadership around areas of opportunity that we see that are needed, and also provide research, data, and analytics and resources to reach the community. We might even do things in the future like how to submit a FOIA request, what to do if the town says that they don't have any information. Again, things that other towns are doing within the Commonwealth, and I think it's wise that we're doing it here as well. And then lastly, what to expect. So we're going to do some deep diving, like Matt said, into some topics and concerns that I think we and taxpayers, other taxpayers, have top of mind. We'll provide some analysis on the current state of affairs. And then we'll talk about the podcast schedule going forward. I think we're going to do this every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Seems to be a good cadence. And that kind of leads us into where we are. So I think the first topic I wanted to talk about, which I know has gotten a lot of interest on the Facebook posts that I have, are the vehicles that are being funded by the taxpayer. And apparently there's a list of vehicles that we're told doesn't exist, but we have pretty good reason to believe that the vehicle list does exist.
Excuse me real quick, John.
Yeah.
You just referenced your Facebook post. And for those who are unaware of these Facebook posts, where would somebody find those posts? And is there a moniker? It's a rhetorical question. I know that there are monikers for the various posts that you have, but if you want to just...
Good plug question.
Okay, yeah. There's no leading the witnesses here.
Yeah. You can find the post by searching me on John Barella and sending me a friend request. You will find two posts that I regularly have posted within the last couple months. One, we have Transparency Tuesday, and it's by definition to bring more and greater transparency to local government. And then Freedom Friday, that generally is a post about FOIA requests that either myself or others have made of the town government. And it keeps them, being the town government, keeps them honest in terms of what material they are wanting and willing to share to the taxpayer, which owns the material and the data, and what data and material they've been unwilling to share. And that kind of turns us back to this list of vehicles. So on Facebook, I did have a Transparency Tuesday post on September 30th called SUV, and that was entitled Spending Uncontrollably on Vehicles and Spurious Undetected Vehicles. So let's kind of break it down in the two steps. We've been provided a list of vehicles that the town has been funding, I think unbeknownst to the taxpayer. I don't know how much information has ever been publicly made about this, but what we found on the vehicle list that I had done with a FOIA request, which you can find on the town's website, was under FOIA request 25405. There's a list of many vehicles. What we're really focused on primarily are the vehicles that are put out under a contract that the select board had written for, you know, being allowed to take home vehicles, drive to and from places of residence under the auspices of 24-hour service. And I think there's a big issue with that. Primarily, I think to the taxpayer, it's a large and unnecessary expense, in my opinion, and in the opinion of others who I've talked with. I think there are much more cost-effective ways of handling the taxpayer assets. I think there's much more cost-effective ways in handling the taxpayer expense. One of those ideas was to simply just do away with town-funded vehicles, except for maybe police chief, fire chief, folks that really do respond on a 24-hour basis. And then in addition to that, there is a problem with the town wanting to release the records of whom the vehicles are assigned to. Now, I received a FOIA request response from the town manager, Jay McGrail, indicating to me that no such list existed, but they would have to create such a list. And it kind of begs the question, I guess, Matt, and I'll throw it back to you. If the town doesn't have such a list of town-owned vehicles, is that a good thing or is that or not, I guess?
Absolutely not. I look at things basically, for lack of a better term, in a simplistic fashion. I look at things like on a personal level. If finances, personal finances. We have when, you know, just about everybody has bank accounts, whether they're checking accounts, saving accounts, money market accounts, etc. We have bank accounts. And something that we receive at the end of every month is a statement. And it shows us exactly what is in our account. And it has in the ledger any deposits or withdrawals that occur in that account. Mm-hmm. So on a personal level, we, of course, we have accountability for our own finances. Mm-hmm. How much more so when we're talking about a town that has $120 million annual budget? I think something as large as vehicles on not only just the cost of procurement, but maintenance, fuel, taxes, registration, which is something I'm sure we're going to get into as well. Like there's a lot of associated costs with these vehicles.
Yeah.
And so to say that there isn't a list of the vehicles that we currently have, and if they are take-home vehicles, who has them? Mm-hmm. I mean, just from an insurance standpoint, a liability standpoint, that's critical must-know information.
Sure.
Because who's on the hook if someone like the DPW director, Chris Peck, gets in an accident off at any time, whether it's during working hours or non-working hours? Well, insurance is going to come into that. Mm-hmm. And we need to know, like, all the circumstances surrounding it. I think part of that, too, is what are the rules governing take-home town vehicles? Are they for use 24/7? Are they for strictly work activities, or can they be used for personal activities? Mm-hmm. Like these are serious questions that need to be answered. And I know in my professional life, I'm a lineman, and my vehicle that I have, number one, I respond to emergency call out, broken poles in the middle of the night. I don't have a vehicle at my house. Like I have to go to my garage. I have to get the vehicle that I'm taking out to the job site. I have to get all the equipment and then go out there. And that's a critical event. Mm-hmm. Number one, it's a safety issue because more times than not, it's involving a motor vehicle accident. Sometimes it is storm damage, but by and large, I would say the majority of them are motor vehicle accidents. Mm-hmm. And so we respond to chaos. We respond to an unsafe situation and we have to make it safe. We have to restore order.
Right.
And
sounds a lot like a really 24/7 operation.
It really is. Yeah. And but at the same time too is we don't and in full disclosure, it wouldn't really be feasible to have, if anybody's familiar with line vehicles, digger derricks and bucket trucks.
It's tough to get that through a donkey's drive-through.
I don't recommend attempting. I've seen other people that have tried to do so, and it doesn't end well. But the logistics of it really doesn't make sense. I mean, they're oversized vehicles. Sometimes, you know, we have 45-foot poles that are on the back of the trailer. So there's a lot that goes into it. But the point being is that is a 24-hour operation. We don't get a call at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, oh, well, all our guys are sleeping and we'll be out there at 7:30. We start at 7 tomorrow and we'll be out there at 7:30, 8 o'clock tomorrow. No, time is of the essence. We have to restore order. So, and with those vehicles, we have to inspect them. We have to do pre-trip inspections. They're also monitored by GPS.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we have any of that type of technology here in town? I don't think we do, but I
don't know, but that's something that everybody is fully aware of, that, they're being tracked by GPS and be where you're supposed to be.
Domino's, I think, even has that in their vehicles, right? When you order a pizza, you can track them on the Domino's app.
That's a great point.
You know? So now one of the things that I'm really curious about, John, is when you put in the public records request, the table doesn't exist. This record does not exist. Was that the basis for a denial of issuance? I'm not sure if it was or not. It was.
It was,
because I see that being a theme in a lot of denials, is there are no substantive records that exist to provide to the requester, and therefore we are not required to create records. And I notice a lot of local governments rely on this carve out of the lack of a requirement to create records, which time and again the Secretary of State's office has indicated.
Yeah.
Creating a record from records that already exist is not creating a new record. You are just compiling the data points that already exist into a digestible format for the citizen's request. So we know the town knows what vehicles they bought.
Of course they do.
We know they know who they got assigned to, mm-hmm. hopefully. Mm-hmm. We know they know what the insurance cost is on them. And sure, I'm willing to entertain that these data points may exist in disparate tables,
sure.
but it is still the obligation of the town to take that disparate information and provide it to the requester.
Yeah.
That's the spirit of the law, and there is nothing to restrict that. When you did share your original records request, mm-hmm. I breezed through it quickly, and I saw a comment about VINs. Mm. They said the VINs don't exist, and I was curious where that played into it, because part of me was wondering if they were going to try and leverage the carve-out for personally identifiable information,
right.
Which I've also seen as a tactic used by some local governments to deny records requests.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think in the Freedom of Information Act that was submitted, they did redact all the VIN numbers, even from things like trailers and, you know, old farm vehicles. Mm-hmm. But one thing I definitely want to point out is not only does the town know that the vehicles exist, they actually have a policy that says it should exist. And I'm going to read it to you. And this is from the town's own vehicle policy. It's point number 5. It says, effective with the implementation of this policy and each December 1st thereafter, the board, meaning the select board, shall be provided with a list of employees assigned municipal vehicles on a 24-hour basis, as well mileage of their one-way commute. So right here off the bat, without doing much digging, we see a select board that's not in compliance with its own rules, which kind of begs the question people have, which is, why not? Now, I've reached out to the select board chair, Mark Germain, and asked him quite candidly why there has been no compliance with this policy and when do they expect to become compliant with the policy. I've not heard back from Mark yet. And that's concerning because Mark does serve us,
mm-hmm.
not the other way around. And so I'm optimistic that Mark Germain will at some point provide this information, or whether that's Jay McGrail or someone with the town, to your point about consolidating data from different places. But this seems like a pretty straightforward list that, per their own town policy, they should have been receiving on a yearly basis anyway. Mm-hmm. To Matt's point, keeping track of assets, you know, two examples. The town manager has a Chevy Tahoe. It's a $60,000 vehicle. Chris Peck, the DPW director, has a $60,000, give or take, Chevy Tahoe. It's $105,000 in two vehicles, and the select board doesn't know where those vehicles are or who they're assigned to.
Sorry, what were the costs associated with both those vehicles?
Well, I believe on the list that they sent us, they were listed at like $56,000 or $57,000. I think somewhere in that $55,000 to $60,000 range. So in the FOIA request, it stated, adding the two numbers, you got $105,000.
Right.
Well, that's just two of the 25 vehicles mm-hmm. that they said go out on a daily basis. So when you think about the town, and according to the town, we were told by Eric Machado, who's the chair of the finance committee at the current time, that the town pays cash for all these vehicles. I don't know what funding source is coming from.
The finance director, Susan Nickerson, also supported that. There's no loans on, they're not leased,
right.
that they're paid for in cash. So
right.
that wasn't just Eric, but that was also the finance director, Sue Nickerson, who stated as such. So
I think there's more questions coming down the way that the town should expect to answer, because I think the people
there's lots of ancillaries right too. I mean, when you consider everything with a vehicle, I'm not sure if it differs for town or government vehicles. insurance, though? I know that different towns in this state, depending on the zip code or zip code that your vehicle is garaged in, you're going to pay a different insurance rate.
Right.
I don't believe any of our 24-hour vehicle holders are in a town that may suffer from a higher insurance rate. However, those mileages also increase your insurance rates. So what are we declaring to our vehicle insurers when we tell them the yearly mileage that that's being put on these vehicles? Because that's all a risk and a liability to the insurance agents as well.
Yep.
Well, also another thing to keep in mind as far as insurance goes is, again, speaking from my experience, driving a company vehicle, we're not to have passengers. Uh-huh. It's only for company company employees. Uh-huh. Okay. Like, I can't pick my wife up or pick my son up and being like, hey, I'll pick you up from school in a company uh-huh. vehicle. Like, we're expressly forbidden from doing that. And it's for liability purposes.
Yep. Or you look at other private employers when they have commuting clauses. Most of them, if you take a job with a private company, they're not going to pay you to commute. Unless you commute beyond to a separate location. But, you know, if we have certain individuals that have decided to work for the town of Middleborough and also decided that they can keep residence 60 miles away,
Right. Should
that cost be borne by the residents of Middleborough, or should there be a line drawn?
And that's a great point. John and I had actually spoken about this just today, yep. as a matter of fact. And, I mean, I know from back when I was a government contractor, there was a little bait and switch on the position that I had taken. Originally, it was supposed to be a lot closer to where I was living at the time, only to then find out that, it was a typo in the job description, that it was actually placed much further away. And, I mean, I was driving 140 miles round trip. Mm-hmm. Never once did I get reimbursed for mileage.
Yep.
And we discussed this. It's like if there was an all hands conference, which we would have annually, that was different.
Yeah.
Submit a travel and expense form. Those costs were covered. But day to day commuting to and from the job, like, that's unfortunately a cost of doing business.
Some other towns will do stipends. Just yep. it's if you incur costs, here's what we will cover up to.
Right.
Lakeville are next door neighbor, for their town manager, they have a $400 per month allowance that they mm-hmm. give to the town manager. And that covers basically the incidental costs that come with being the town manager, mm-hmm. going to special events or anything that arises that fall within the scope and authority of the town manager.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's completely acceptable. Like, I don't have a problem with making a job more desirable to attract yeah. the best candidates,
yeah.
regardless of where they live. But it also has to be within reason.
Yeah.
Like, we can't be giving away the farm. And in a lot of cases, that's what it seems like to mm-hmm. me. I mean, just going through the very limited town vehicle lists that we have, as John previously mentioned, there's 25 of them that are take-home, town-owned assets, vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Fire Chief Owen Thompson, absolutely. That right. makes yeah. complete sense.
Right.
Police Chief Robert Ferreira, absolutely. Makes all the sense in the world. They're literally in the business of life and death.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so we just had a few months back, we had a tragedy where someone was stabbed.
Mm-hmm.
I want my police chief to be able to get there Agreed. In the most expedient manner possible.
Agreed. Yeah.
Likewise with the fire chief. I want them there. Like, and so we're not arguing that point.
Right, right.
But some of the ones that are listed here, building inspector. I don't know. I've never heard of a building inspector having to go out at 2:00 in the morning to issue a building permit. Likewise, wiring inspector. Mm-hmm. And I could be wrong. I mean, far be it from me to be a subject matter expert on these things. Mm-hmm. And
actually, I'm pretty sure there's carve-outs in state laws regarding emergency repairs that are conducted that don't require inspections if they're not available at that time immediately, but they must be done within X time frame. So, no, I can't imagine or conceive of a time when we would need an emergency on-call wiring inspection performed.
I mean, town engineer. Much. town engineer. Like, what is being engineered at 2 o'clock in the morning that, wait a minute, before we can put a shovel in the ground, we need the town engineer here. Mm-hmm. Like, it just doesn't make sense to me. And I mean, going back to the DPW director, I suppose an argument could be made, but at the same time, what work is a Chevy Tahoe? Like, how is that piece of equipment enabling a job to be done? And then it also begs the question too, is like, how often are these people getting called in? Mm-hmm. If this is like a weekly event, then okay, I guess that would be an argument too.
I would have a separate set of questions if they were being called into weekly emergencies.
Right, exactly. So I think there's just a lot of questions here saying like, what is the net benefit to the residents and taxpayers?
Devil's advocate, I certainly don't want to diminish the role of the town manager or the head of the DPW or any. I mean, these are all in the event of an emergency or a crisis, they're important roles.
Yes.
And I do expect that to be available.
Yes.
The question is, how much are we spending on an annual basis for that availability? And is there a more cost-effective way to do it? And should that be put up to the residents of the community to influence that decision?
And I think that's all we're saying. And I think that, you know, at the budget summit meeting, which we were both in attendance for, we heard a lot of talk about all of a sudden there's belt tightening. Mm-hmm. And in the Facebook post, I thought, you know, well, what better way to do some belt tightening than just look at what's out there obvious, such as 25 take-home vehicles. To your point, it's not to denigrate or diminish the work that folks are doing. It's important work. It's critical work. It's work that's very much appreciated. But with a business and financial perspective and lens, and a managerial approach, putting some thought into the dollars that the taxpayers are being asked to spend makes sense. And as members of the Finance Committee and also as a taxpaying citizen, you know, our charge is to be the fiscal watchdog of Middleborough. And I would posit that if we're not asking these questions, which could be difficult and uncomfortable for some people to receive, I get that, then we're not doing our job effectively. And we owe it to the people who elected us to do our job to the best of our ability. And will that at times create consternation? Yes. Will that at times create uncomfortable situations that people need to be held accountable for? Yes. Have we ever found ourselves being personally attacked? Yes. Have we ever personally attacked? No. And so I think that this also leads to a bigger, broader question of how people are treated within our town, either as elected officials or as constituents that may want to attend a meeting. We'll be talking about some of those things in greater detail on another podcast. But for right now, we'll stick with the vehicles. And I do want to get into the license plate thing, too, before we wrap up and then we talk about what's next. Because in addition to these town vehicles, I don't know if you want to go ahead and kind of tackle it or not, but I'm ready to talk about the vehicles and the plates and so forth because, you know, my conversations with law enforcement, I guess there's an issue with blue plates, which is the municipal plates that my understanding based on conversations with law enforcement, all municipal vehicles that are registered within the town should have. Now, we've come to find out that there are certain town take-home vehicles that do not have these blue municipal plates on them, and that kind of begs a question as to why. And so maybe I'll toss it back to you or you to throw your two cents in on that.
Sure. And one of the things, just going back very briefly, is you talked about the response when some of these questions are asked. And far too often, and I'm going to trot out my saying that I use quite frequently, oftentimes there's been a disproportionate response to the question. Sometimes there's things that to the uninformed person, it looks wrong or it looks questionable, but then clarifying with a subject matter expert, no, that's actually it's proper, it's legal, it's common. Not to say that common is always right, but we sometimes have a misunderstanding. We think something is wrong when in fact nothing is wrong. But when that's the case, usually there's a proportionate response and it's clarified in very short order. And another thing I say a lot is if something can be explained easily, then easily explain it. Mm-hmm. And that's where we've had more times than I can count where they're not easily explained. Instead, we get that disproportionate response. So, and I think this next topic too is with the registration, the license plate issue. I think that falls into that category too. If there's a case in point, there's undercover police vehicles. I don't think it is appropriate, common practice, that an undercover vehicle is going to have a blue municipal plate with police on it.
Hey, look at me.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to have on the side of it Middleborough Police, even if it is kind of the
shadowy,
the subtle markings, but it's completely legal.
You're giving me Miami Vice vibes with the Ferrari.
Right. So, I mean, that, of course, we're not questioning that, but going back to the town manager, Jay McGrail, he has a Tahoe that, by all indications, is, based on the list, a town-owned asset. Why, then, does it not have a municipal plate? Mm.
All right. Well, after a quick little break so we could swap out the audio card, we can dive right back into it. Matt, you were talking about the pan plates on some of the town vehicles and how some commentary from law enforcement.
Yes, and this is based on a conversation. John would be better suited to expand on this. But, yeah, so police vehicles, as I previously mentioned, have undercover vehicles that obviously makes sense that they have just nondescript plates. However, again, the town manager, he's not a law enforcement officer. I don't think he's working undercover for the police department or any other law enforcement agency in the Commonwealth. So it begs the question, why? Why have a nondescript plate? And again, going back, is one of the reasons why we have municipal plates is so the stakeholder, i.e. the residents and taxpayers, they can see that that's a town-owned asset. Mm-hmm. And for accountability purposes.
Yeah, I know that when I drive down the highway, I'm looking for those trucks owned by businesses. So if they do anything untoward, I can contact that business.
Right.
I'd want to do the same thing with the town of Middleborough.
Sure.
If I saw a vehicle of ours behaving erratically on the road, yeah, I'm going to call the town and say, hey, what's up with this vehicle?
Maybe they should all have those bumper stickers that says, how's my driving?
Yeah.
You know, and to say, call this number, and maybe it goes right to the town manager's office. I don't know. I'm just a thought. On the subject of the 25 take-home vehicles, you know, the two of which that have been prominently kind of discussed, I'm wondering how many other vehicles are out there with non-blue tags. And so the goal of this podcast too is, in addition to sort of bringing a lot of issues to light, is to be interactive. So we would pose the question to anyone who works at the town, whether that be the town manager, anyone on the select board, is this a policy that is legal, and can you please explain why certain vehicles that appear to need blue plates don't have those blue plates? Maybe there's a justification, maybe there's a reason. However, as taxpayers who own those vehicles, we have a right to know. And then also, we want to be reactive and proactive to our audience. And so what we want to do is announce that we do have email addresses. And I'm going to let Tom talk a little bit about that because he's the subject matter expert on the tech side. And then I think, you know, it's noontime. People are ready to go out to lunch. We can wrap it up and we can then talk about what we're going to talk about next time.
Sounds good.
Yeah, absolutely. John, like you said, we just got it set up. So the GOAT podcast does have a dedicated email now. It is living on the Cardinal Tenants infrastructure. So it is GOAT, G-O-A-T, at cardinaltenants.com. I'm going to make sure that we get that spread out online. You know, we'll share it through Facebook, other social media posts. And it has its own landing page in the Cardinal Tenants website. Matt John and myself, we all have our own emails at Tommy Goat, Johnny Goat, and Matty Goat at cardinaltenants.com. But anybody that were to email goat at cardinaltenants.com, it would automatically get forwarded to all three of us as well.
Perfect.
So we want to make sure to get as many channels out there as we can, so people that want to hear different topics being discussed, bring up new ideas or thoughts or insights onto stuff to discuss on the podcast, we give them a way to do that.
Great. And before I forget, so tonight, for everyone who's out in the listening and hearing audience, town meeting, 7 o'clock, high school. I know we'll all be there. I'm encouraging everyone to come out, have your voices heard, meet your elected officials, ask them questions, hold them accountable. Same likewise goes for us. We're elected officials. We're just as accountable to people. I think our track record speaks for itself. So I would encourage that for everybody. And then the next episode, I think podcast number 2, we're going to discuss DPW turnover expenses. That seems to be a hot topic, as well as TIFs. So stay tuned for more of that. We'll probably broadcast again in 2 weeks. And Matt and Mr. Rochars, any closing comments before we head out?
I just want to say one thing is, first off, something right on the nose. You failed to acknowledge our mascot.
Yeah, I haven't done that yet. I'll save that for the end.
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry. I didn't mean to steal your thunder. But the other thing is, as John just said, is we're elected officials on the Finance Committee. Speaking for myself, and I know the same for John, I have no ulterior motives when I ran for Finance Committee other than to basically set foot in the sausage factory and see how the sausage is made. Mm-hmm. Finance Committee does exactly that when it comes to municipal spending. It's kind of the sausage factory. You see how the sausage is made. And that was my only interest. My only goal was to have a greater understanding of how our tax dollars are being spent and to advocate for the taxpayer. And it should be noted that neither one of us ceded our rights as residents and taxpayers in Middleborough by merely volunteering and serving on the Finance Committee. We are still residents and taxpayers of the town of Middleborough. And I think, and that's first and foremost. Secondarily, we're on the Finance Committee, but first and foremost, we're residents and taxpayers mm-hmm. of this town. And I think that based on some of the disproportionate responses that we've received, there's this almost contempt that the residents are held with. You know, it's like mm-hmm. it just feels, it could be wrong. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm just,
I don't think it's just you.
a delicate blossom. Maybe I just, but
I've occasionally got
Marine. I don't think he's a very delicate blossom.
Yeah.
I've occasionally gotten that feeling of, let them eat cake.
Yeah. It's like, it's this feeling that we just treat with utter contempt and that we answer to them when in fact, that's not how it's supposed to be. That's an unhealthy relationship. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've used the analogy before of in a corporation, you have a CEO. The CEO serves at the pleasure of the board of directors. The board of directors are answer to the shareholders. Mm-hmm. Okay. In this case, the CEO would be Jay McGrail. Okay. The board of directors would be not just the board of selectmen. They would be the most powerful entity based on their authority. But Finance Committee, we're part of that as well. Mm-hmm. But then ultimately, our shareholders are the voters. They're the residents, the taxpayers mm-hmm. of Middleborough. That's who we answer to. And in a healthy relationship, governmental relationship, that's the lens through which this should be looked at, is the town employees, the elected officials, they answer to the people, mm-hmm. okay? Not the other way around. So I just wanted to emphasize that point. So this is to those people who live in Middleborough, who watch this podcast, let it be known. This is your town.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This isn't the Board of Selectmen's town. It's not the town manager's town. This is your town, and it's time to take it back.
Yep, I agree.
Yep. And, you know, you guys both spoke a lot about accountability, you know, as elected officials. And for the record, I am not elected and I have absolutely no accountability. No,
just a private taxpayer.
I do believe in a lot of accountability. And that goes for me as a private citizen as well. You know, I launched a website that is, its sole purpose is to promote transparency, accountability, reasonableness, common sense. And if I ever produce something or support something that doesn't go to that end, I believe in holding myself accountable for that as well. I think that everybody on this planet has some level of accountability. Those that are elected, certainly you bought in for a little bit more accountability than others.
There is, there's a higher level, right?
Absolutely. You know, so I think that it's important that people remember that as citizens, that, like you said, Matt, this is our town, it's our state, it's our country. And I think that we've seen a lot of disengagement in citizens when it comes to voting, when it comes to showing up for town meetings. And I can't help but wonder if a lot of that is driven by a lack of confidence that they actually have any agency in it. And they do. The town people, the people of the town of Middleborough have a boatload of agency. Mm. They just need to show up and act on it.
Agreed. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here. And I want to certainly thank our audience. And hopefully we will continue to improve and evolve this podcast. It's not going anywhere. We're not going anywhere. We're looking to bring more transparency, more oversight, more accountability to the town of Middleborough on behalf of the taxpayers of Middleborough. And I appreciate everybody's time. So thanks very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you both. All right. And on that note, that's a wrap on episode 1.
See you in episode 2.
See you in episode 2.